today on Against the Grain. You live in the U.S., but you hail from an enemy nation, a nation the U.S. has long considered a threat to its interests and its security. Siamak Vusuri writes stories about the lives, perspectives, and anxieties of Iranian Americans. I'm C.S. The Tehran-born, San Francisco-based writer joins me to discuss his new book, Better Than War, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We hear about Iran. We hear about tensions between the U.S. and Iran. Some of us have heard about the CIA-directed coup that, in 1953, overthrew the Iranian prime minister. Well, hundreds of thousands of people who trace their ancestry to Iran live in the U.S., and how often do we hear about them? They no doubt have stories to tell about living in a nation suspicious, always suspicious of Iran's intentions, a nation that considers Iran an enemy despite the deal recently reached on Iran's nuclear program. Siamak Vusuri is interested in those stories. He was born in Tehran, and his father was a political prisoner in Iran under the Shah. After living for 4 years in England, Siamak and his family moved to Southern California and then to Seattle, where Siamak earned a bachelor's in English before moving to San Francisco in 1994. His first book, a new short story collection called Better Than War, has received a Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction. When Siamak Vusuri joined me in studio, I asked him what his writing is fundamentally about.
I would describe my writing as trying to find the beauty of life through the fullness of life, by trying to appreciate life in all its forms, you know, in all its beauty and ugliness, in all its joy and sadness, and to try to say that it's worth it for all of us to live as much as we can while we're alive. And out of that comes a lot of personal experience, comes a lot of stories having to do or in some way related to childhood, because I think kids know that instinctively. And trying to say that we can be as great as our dreams.
Yeah, in fact, the epigraph of your book is lyrics from a song by the band Pearl Jam. The words are dream the dreams of other men. What does that mean to you?
That one means several things. One, I was happy to include that in the epigraph because of my Seattle roots. But also, it means something to me both in terms of life and both as well as writing. I'll speak on the life part first. I think a kind of moving through the world in a way that seeks to operate around people in a way that says that what is in you is in me and what is in me is in you. And to understand that the point of going into yourself and digging as deeply as you can in there is to understand how deep everybody else goes as well, whether it is in writing or in whatever they might do. And in terms of writing, it's a way to understand characters in your story, is to understand that every single character in your story, from the most major to the most minor, has their own dreams. And that's the way that they should be understood to bring their full humanity out in the story. So I like that as an epigraph because I felt like it applied to life and writing in a way that I aspire to.
It's interesting to me that in your talking about your writing, you haven't yet mentioned Iran or Iranian-American immigrants. So how important is it for you to tell that particular story in light of or informed by the themes you've been talking about so far?
Yeah, it's very important. You know, I came to literature through American literature. And as a result of that, I didn't have any models that reflected my own culture and background. I had models in terms of other immigrant writers, other people of color who'd been writers, and those meant a great deal to me. But I was slow to coming around to the understanding of myself as an Iranian American writer. It happened, I would say, sometime in like mid to late 20s or so. But since then, I feel like it does overlap very nicely for me with the idea of dreaming the dreams of other men, because I want to show an American audience the kinds of dreams that occupy our hearts, not because I'm asking to be seen as just as human, but because they haven't heard them. And I'm always conscious of that. I'm always conscious of what stories haven't been heard, haven't been told. And that doesn't mean that necessarily that I set out to fill that void on purpose. It can't help but happen on its own. And so I don't try to fight it. But I would say that my roots being in American literature, it means a lot to me to also be able to talk about Iran and to talk about Iranians in what I think is an American voice. And I can't write about Iran. I left there when I was 2. I can only write about what I know in a meaningful way. And so I can't get around the fact that that voice is American. So how that all works together is something that I feel like is a lifelong process, but I appreciate the adventure of learning it.
So you talk about sharing stories about your experience, about the immigrant experience, to people here in the U.S. And what's interesting about your book is that a number of characters in your short stories, they seem to me to have a great amount of difficulty relating their story or telling their side of the story or saying what, for example, the year 1953 means to them. So is that partly what the book is about, is the difficulty of conveying one's feelings and one's stories to people who are, frankly, often ignorant of what else is going on around the world, including in a place like Iran?
Yeah, absolutely. You refer to the story called 1953, and that's a year that means a great deal to Iranians and means a lot in particular to my family. My dad remembers it well and remembers everything about the feeling of the time. And for him, it's the central year, not just in his own life, but in his understanding of the relationship between Iran and the U.S. That relationship goes both ways. And just because it isn't acknowledged both ways doesn't mean it still doesn't flow both ways. For example, it flows both ways in the way that my parents have been here for 30 years and they don't really make American friends. They don't really find themselves being able to become very close with Americans. They get along, they are cordial, they're polite, they have acquaintances, but to have that deeper kind of friendship, it would take an understanding of the two countries' relationship in the way that my parents have and in the way that many Americans don't have. So you're right in saying that it's not just the telling of the stories. It's also a very purposeful effort to say, here is what we tell each other in private, and here is how, here is our worries and our concerns about showing vulnerabilities in America. And it's hard to show in life, but there's ways to show it on paper.
And 1953 being the year that Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected prime minister of Iran, when his government was overthrown in a coup organized by the CIA, that was 1953. So in the story 1953, in your book, Better Than War, there's this man and he's walking around an old car show and picnic in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, looking at all the big 1950s cars. And so what is he thinking? What is he wondering about in the sense of, so he's got some kind of 1953 in his heart and mind. other people have their own sense of 1953, often imbued with this nostalgia about beautiful cars and, you know, life in the 1950s. What is the main protagonist of the story, this Iranian-American male? What is he struggling with?
I think what he's struggling with is the realization that as long as he's here, and really as long as he's alive, I think, the difficulty is going to be in holding both stories. And there's really no way around it. And I wanted it to be set in the park at the picnic with the people standing next to their cars, because another thing that he does in the story is he becomes a lot more engaged and fascinated with the people than with the cars. And he's kind of an exception in the crowd for doing that. But to him, the cars matter because they hold the stories of these people. And he wants to believe that there'll be a time where they can take in his story in the same way that he can take in theirs. And the only answer for him in the moment is for somebody to hold both, you know? And actually, I just want to say real quick that this is an aspect of living in the U.S. as an Iranian that I really benefited the most from reading African-American literature. Going back to W.E.B. Du Bois and the double consciousness that he talked about of being Black and being American, you know, I tried to think about, especially during the Iraq War, to which there's some references in the book as well, where looking the way I did, being from the part of the world that I was from, made me feel as un-American sometimes walking around the street as possible. But, you know, I know what's in my heart. I know, like, the language that I seek to write in. I know the America that's in me. And from somebody like Du Bois, and especially from somebody like James Baldwin, who said that he, you know, was never going to get the America out of him. I really, really took that to heart, and it was incredibly helpful to me to say that even as low as I felt during the Iraq War, that you can't fight what's in your heart, you can't fight the way that you grow up, but you can make bigger space, you can make more room in there, and your heart can survive that.
Siamak Vusuri is his name. He's an Iranian-American writer and the author of a new short story collection. It's called Better Than War. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. That story also suggests to me, I think something in that story indicated to me that it would take a kind of psychic effort for this Iranian-American to believe in, to take in the Americans, 1953, their story of 1953, to let in their 1953 in good faith. And I think I'm taking those words from your story. So to me, that says, well, psychic effort on both sides then, right? That there's going to be some kind of considerable task involved in each person acknowledging and understanding their respective stories, the other's stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, but you often see, I think, some beautiful examples of this. You know, I'm reminded of an article I was reading recently about American Vietnam War veterans going back to Vietnam many years later and talking to people against whom they were fighting at that time, and acknowledging what they did and acknowledging that it didn't have to be this way and gaining an understanding of one another's stories, you know, in ways that are really beautiful. And so I believe that I can keep trying to do it. It really feels like sometimes the only option, you know. And I'm really heartened by the fact that when you go down that road, me as an Iranian American, I can see so many other examples of immigrant groups who came here before me, who had to negotiate this in certain ways. And we find a lot of connections through that. And it's just a way to draw down boundaries within yourself and then to meet other people in ways that are boundaryless. You know, it's a constant effort. It's never something that anybody's going to have down pat, I don't think. But it's not only positive for living, but I think it's really positive for art and for writing to always be going back to the epigraph again, to be able to see the person you're writing about as somebody with their own dreams allows that character to really live.
There is a story in this collection about a man who, as a boy, had been a prisoner in his home country, I assume Iran, although I don't think it's mentioned, and is now in, apparently, the U.S. And he says to himself, and I'm quoting, if they, by which he means people in the U.S., if they thought that that prison cell was not inside them, they were mistaken. If they thought that a prison cell many years ago in a country halfway around the world was not inside them, they were mistaken. What is this man saying here?
Well, yeah, it goes back to the experience of my father as having been a prisoner in Iran under the Shah. And it's so many third world countries, you know, they, when you start talking to the people from those places, you know, they have similar experiences. They have similar experiences in terms of being victims of American empire, you know, throughout the Cold War and beyond. And they carry these memories very acutely. It's a mistake, I think that what America does abroad does not penetrate the hearts and souls of people here. You know, I don't know exactly how it does. I can't say specifically, but I really do feel like there is some connection between the idea of building material walls elsewhere in the world and building walls inside of people's hearts. Again, going back to the idea of like their difficulties, my parents' difficulties in the U.S., what they're looking for, I think what so many people coming from experiences like that are looking for is just an acknowledgement, you know, an acknowledgement of this is what we went through. This is what, you know, this is what the United States, this is what the West had done in the past. These are the realities of it. And they penetrated people's actual lives in very, very real ways. You know, they exist in history books or foreign policy journals here in the U.S., but they matter in very real ways to people growing up in those kind of circumstances. And it's just impossible to believe that, for me, that it's not a relationship that goes both ways.
Your father was in prison in Iran. He was a political prisoner, incarcerated by the U.S.-backed Shah. What was his quote, crime?
His crime was being politically active against the Shah and to be doing that through political parties that were banned. He was not in prison for a long time, but in Iran, you know, they hold on to your record after you come out. And that was a part of why we ended up leaving afterwards.
The story, The Movie Quitters, is about an Iranian-American man who, as he says, is tired of being moved to tears by American movies. Why is he tired of crying over American movies?
I think that in his indirect sort of roundabout way, he's coming back to the same idea of which stories get let into your heart, you know? The main form of storytelling, I think, that exists in our world today is movies. I think that's fair to say. And the power of movies, the power of American movies to tell stories that do get inside people around the world and build a certain notion around America, it's always important to me to ask who gets three-dimensionalized. Movies are two-dimensional on the screen, but they're three-dimensional, I think, in the way they get into us. And this particular character is aware of how much these movies have gotten inside him. And he looks back later in the story and thinks some of these stories that he knows about America, he only knows from movies. So the fact that like he has a nostalgic vision for America in the 1950s, when he was not a part of that, but movies have made him feel like he ought to be nostalgic for that time period, he can sense that there's also a loss involved in that, a loss in terms of how he holds his own story. And he's asking for a two-way street.
He's asking for an American man to cry at an Iranian movie specifically.
Right. And he does not get his wish, but he comes close and he feels, I think, stronger for the effort.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest is Siamak Vusuri. And on againstthegrain.org, we have a link to his new book. It's a short story collection. It's called Better Than War. It received a 2014 Flannery O'Connor Award for short fiction. Siamak is a Tehran-born, San Francisco-based writer, and his writing has appeared in many journals. We have a link on againstthegrain.org also to his homepage on the web. I wonder if you could read one of your stories, Siamak, and let's turn to In the Library, which again is a story in this collection called Better Than War. Please read it, and then let's talk about it.
All right. In the Library. The two boys sat in the library after school. The newspaper on the table was open to an article about their country. Iran sentences women to death by stoning, it said. They had read it. It was difficult to go straight to their chemistry homework after reading it. I don't remember hearing anything about stoning when we were still there, Mohammad Reza said. You were probably too young, Kayvon said. I was 7. You were probably too young. Well, somebody should have told me. What good would that have done? I don't know. The two boys had both covered their chemistry books in paper that was bright green, the color of the national protest movement. Sometimes it helped them to feel close to Iran. Other times they felt very far. Some girls from their class were sitting at the next table. They were whispering excitedly about the upcoming school dance. Neither of the boys was going. They both had dreams of going. They hadn't told each other those dreams. They were very good friends, but they hadn't told each other those dreams. I would jump in front of her if I was there, Mohammad Reza said. They would shoot you. Mohammad Reza shrugged. I would do something. I would pick up a rock and pretend to miss and hit one of the people throwing a rock instead. Yes, that's it. Pretend to be the worst thrower in the world. It could be a distraction. You could get all the people in the crowd to throw rocks at each other instead. It felt good to think of pretending to be bad throwers. They knew it wasn't going to feel good for long, but it was nice to imagine. It was good to have somebody at school to be angry with. They each had a place to be angry at home, too. But with each other, they could be angry and funny and other things. There was another boy in their class who was Iranian, and they played basketball with him on weekends. But his family was royalist, and whenever he heard about something bad in Iran, he talked about America doing something to Iran about it. They believe that bombs can be messages of hope, Kayvon's father had told him about them. I don't know why this is, but they believe it. They watched the girls sitting at the next table. They hadn't told each other about their dreams of going to the dance, but that was partly because it was obvious. It would be a dance, and a girl in a dress, and arriving there together at night. What was there to tell? It would be a dream. If they were going to be angry about some things, it was good to have some things they dreamed of, too. The woman in the article had been convicted of killing her husband, who had abused her. The boys knew how it was in Iran. Women were supposed to be under men's control, even if the men were doing something like that. The way they were told it was not like that in America. The way they were told it, a woman could be anything she wanted to be. It did not make them feel better about anything. It did not make them feel better about being in America. One of the girls at the next table had asked them once why they always read the newspaper. They hadn't understood her question. They thought she was asking why they didn't read a different newspaper. But she was asking why they read something that was so far away from them. It was hard not to think after that they wanted to go to the dance with a boy who did not read the newspaper. The two boys believed that they would want to know what was happening in Iran even if they weren't Iranian. It was because the dance was half the story. The other half was the world. What was happening in the article was very far from them as they sat in the library, but they didn't think the idea was to call it very far from them. It was to call it very near to them and then to figure out how that was true. They threw themselves out to some place where they knew they didn't know what to do once they were there. But they thought that someday they could throw themselves out there and they would know what to do there. And it didn't matter if there were girls who did not want to go to the dance with a boy who read the newspaper. They had to be thinking of the woman in the article. They had to be thinking of what they owed her. Just then, their friend Alex came into the library. They waved, and he began walking to their table. "Close the newspaper," Kayvon said. "Why?" "I don't like the way they read things like this, about women in Iran." "What do you mean?" "They read it to prove a point, to prove they are right about something. It is not the right way to read it." Mohammad Reza closed the newspaper. Alex joined them, and after talking for a few minutes, they began to get to work on their chemistry homework.
Siamak Vusuri reading his story in the library, which is part of his new collection called Better Than War. There's so many interesting ideas and I think a lot of wisdom in this story. What motivated you to write this?
Part of what motivated me was I had a chance to go to a Iranian-American youth camp that was in the Bay Area that my sister worked at. And it was a really nice thing to see because there were something around 100 young Iranian-American high school kids coming to this camp from all over the country and being in a place where they could feel like themselves, could recognize one another in themselves for perhaps the first time for many of them. And it got me thinking about the nature of their particular relationships. You know, I had been a high school kid in the U.S. in the 80s, and that had its own particular dimension to it. But I wasn't a high school kid in the U.S. post 9/11, and I think that that has a different dimension to it. And I wanted to think about those kids and imagine the kind of conversations they have. That part of it is from my imagination, but the part about needing to keep conversations, the kinds of critical conversations that we have amongst each other, which include criticisms of our home country, the need to keep those private, the need to not allow those to become vulnerable because of the fear of how they'll be perceived, is very real and very true to, I think, Iranians and other people of any age. So the ending was important to me, and it was especially important to me that they had to keep it secret from a friend because they were already arranging their life in such a way that a friend is a friend and you hang out with him, you do your homework with him, and there are things that because of where he's coming from and because of where you're coming from, you have to keep secret because it's not safe to share.
So in other words, they can disapprove of the stoning, but somehow the disapproval of the stoning by people who are not immigrants, who are not Iranian Americans, that would carry perhaps a certain kind of judgment about them or about their country that they really didn't want. Is that because they were trying to think in a more nuanced way about the news that they had just heard?
Yeah, exactly. It's a desire, I think, to look at these kinds of horrific events and rather than say, well, what is wrong with them? I feel like that's an easy question that's asked, you know? But if we as a people, as human beings, can change that question to what is wrong with us, and that us and that what is wrong needs to include not just things that happen there, elsewhere, but things that happen here. You know, they don't feel like their friend will treat the issue in that way. They think that he's going to jump to what is wrong with them. And I think somewhere in them, maybe that's not completely articulated or understood by themselves, but they know that that's an incomplete question. And they know that it's a question that allows somebody to fail to see the big picture, because the real progress of humanity needs to be a collective progress. And what is wrong with them is almost never a part of that.
Why did it not make the boys feel better to hear that a woman in the U.S. could be anything she wanted to be?
Good question. Yeah, I think it's that part I was trying to refer to the ways in which since 9/11, because that's the setting in which I imagine these two boys, feminism has been used as a weapon sometimes, used as a weapon in, I believe, insincere ways, used in ways to say that because life for women in the U.S. is better, which it is. I'm not denying that. That there's an utter justification for whatever actions that the United States or the West engages in the Middle East. If the only time that American men, I should say in particular, the only time that American men talk about feminism is when they're talking about issues of sexism elsewhere, that's a problem. I think you got to start with yourself and work from there.
So another story in this collection of yours, it's called again Better Than War by my guest Siamak Vusuri, and by the way, I'll spell it now, but you can look up his name on our website, againstthegrain.org. It's spelled S-I-A-M-A-K, and Vusuri is V-O-S-S-O-U-G-H-I. So another story in this collection is called The Street. And The Street begins with two ways that a street might be viewed by a person. What are those two ways?
Yeah, the two ways is the street as a way to get to a place, and the other way is as a place itself.
And why does that interest you?
The story comes out of a time when I used to go to the corner of Powell and Market and sit on the steps of what was then the Bank of America building. And
in San Francisco.
In San Francisco. And try to write about people going by and to try to write about them in a way that saw them. You know, the difference, I think, in the two ways of seeing the street are whether the people on the street are seen or not seen. You know, when you think of the street as a way to get to someplace, then you save your connection with humanity for the place that you're trying to get to. And that's all fine and good. I don't think anybody can be utterly engaged with everybody all the time. But I was very interested in the idea of people on the street really noticing one another. And stopping on the street and trying to write about the people was the first time that I had a way to try to do that as a practice. And so then the story came out of the idea of who else makes the street into a place? And I thought about beggars. I thought about people asking for change. For them, the street is a place because it's a place where either they're going to make the kind of connection that they're looking for or not. And they can't, and they're also stopping, you know, when they're also stopping and sitting and making it into a place by that stopping, which is similar to something that a writer does or can do, I should say.
In another story, you write about Americans always rushing around doing things and going to the next place. So that's the opinion of the main character in that story. Is that your opinion as well?
That was my high school opinion. Yeah, that was the character is supposed to be a young guy trying to make sense of how he wants to be a writer. And I was somebody who, as a writer, like I said earlier, being so influenced by American literature, you know, I had dreams of writing about the U.S. in ways that people like Jack Kerouac and William Saroyan and Thomas Wolfe, these writers who really wanted to get at the heart of something American. I had those kind of dreams, and I still do in a certain way, but it was noticeable to me that sometimes that poetry that I was looking for in life here, I felt lonely with it. I felt like you couldn't go to high school and share a book that you'd read about by an American writer with most of the kids that I grew up with. Wanting to be a writer, wanting to look at things with kind of a poetic eye was sort of a marginalized thing growing up here. That was just my experience, in my own particular experience. And one of the ways that I made sense of that was that I felt like there was value in just stopping and listening and taking things in, and I didn't see that happening around me.
Studs Terkel did a lot of listening, and he wrote a lot of oral histories of people. And in the final story of this collection, a boy picks up a book by Terkel It's a book called Division Street America. It's a book of oral history about people's lives in Chicago. There's a lot we could say about this story, but I want to focus on something the boy says or thinks. I think he thinks that learning about the life of a woman who he didn't know growing up in Chicago, right? So this is a woman in Chicago, and she's telling Turkle her life story, and it's in this book, was an integral part of his effort to figure out who and where he was, the Iranian-American boy. Quote, her childhood in Chicago was very important to understanding where he was. How so?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm still trying to figure it out exactly, but I know that in the beginning of that particular story, he's started reading the book and he goes downstairs to his parents and he says that I figured out what America is. And they ask him what, and he says, it's people. And he finds something striking in the book and in the stories, like the story of the old woman in Chicago, which is that somehow he finds an idea that as long as there are people with stories in this place, I feel like I have a home here. He knows that in real life, it might be absurd to this old woman to share her story directly with him. But that doesn't stop him. What's important is that now he knows that she's got this story, and that somehow it feels to him like it's reached the level of art just by her telling it and by Studs Terkel putting it down on paper and him receiving it. And it gives him a lot of hope in the capacity for himself to make a home here because he feels ready to listen. And listening is a big part of trying to find one's way as a writer, I think, because you feel like doing a lot of telling, but you find after a while that listening allows you to have something to say.
Well, have you thought about just becoming an oral historian and telling other people's stories the way they're telling it, as opposed to, I mean, this comes up in the story, I believe, you know, a writer tells a story his way, right? Even if he's telling a story about someone else, it's his mind and his interpretation of it that comes through.
Yeah, I struggled with this. I struggled with the idea of how one takes in people's stories. The example that comes to mind is when I first moved to San Francisco, I lived in the Tenderloin, and there was some bars in my neighborhood that looked like the kind of places, perhaps somewhat romanticized in my mind, that, you know, when you're starting out as a writer, it felt like I should go in there. I feel like the people have some stories in there, you know. And the first couple times that I went in there, I actually went in with my pencil and paper. And I realized quickly that that's no way to talk to people, you know. It's, for me, like, you have to trust something more organic. You have to, there's something to be said for sure for trying to be a reporter about people's daily lives. And there's a lot to be said for the way that Studs Terkel did it. But it's also, again, kind of coming back to the idea of a two-way street. You know, when you walk in with a pen and paper, the idea is that they're the one with the story and you're the one who's taking it down. And I had to learn that if it's not an exchange, people don't trust it as much, you know, because you need to open up to them as much as vice versa.
Your book has been characterized as belonging to, as being part of a new wave of Iranian-American literature. Do you agree with that? And if so, how would you characterize or describe this new wave?
Well, I think the wave is very new, partly because as an immigrant population, we don't have a very long history in the U.S. I would say what's new about it is now our stories are really being set here. For a while, I think the stories that were being told by Iranian authors were coming out of their experiences in Iran. And they were often seen as needing to belong to one particular category, I think. I mean, I'm happy for anybody who writes a story and I'm happy just for anybody who writes a story, whether it's published or not. But there was, I think, a little bit in the 80s and 90s, a problem with a kind of not without my daughter syndrome. I'm just making that term up right now. But the idea of stories which that were in some form or another how I fled Iran, you know. And I'm not downplaying the truth of those experiences. Those are very real and they deserve to be out there. But sometimes it felt like Iranian and Middle Eastern writing was limited to that. And I think that if there is a new Iranian-American literature, that what we're trying to do is to say that there is a lot more than just that.
Siamak Vusuri, he is an Iranian-American writer, and his new short story collection, which has won a 2014 Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction, it's called Better Than War. We have a link to that on againstthegrain.org. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. Siamak is a Tehran-born, San Francisco-based writer. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Last month, I came across an obituary for a man named William Greer. Greer was a psychiatrist who, with his colleague Price Cobbs, wrote a book called Black Rage. According to Greer's obituary in the New York Times, Black Rage, published in 1968, drew widespread attention to the psychic damage inflicted by racism and to the causes of black anger. Greer and Cobbs ran a psychiatric clinic in San Francisco, and what I have for you are portions of a talk that Price Cobbs gave in 1968 on the topic of Black Rage. Cobbs at the time was also a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California. Here's Price Cobbs speaking at what was then Sacramento State College on October 2nd, 1968.
The crucial thing in the American national character about slavery in this country was when the issue was made on the basis of color. And this is when something permanent came into the American mind, that this is what stamped our system of slavery as different. This is what moved it out of a class kind of thing or a caste kind of thing. It fixed it in a racist mold. If I'm white and you're black, it's okay for me to enslave you. In many other countries, this was never done. And I think if people are enslaved and are of the same color as the enslavers, and the practice stops, then that most irreversible of human traits, pigmentation, is not a bar. If everybody is white and half of those white people are slaves and you stop slavery, then, you know, the name of the game may be education or money or the ability to run fast or run slow, but if all the pigmentation, all the physical characteristics are the same, then the mental set about slavery can drop. If the slave remains as black and the system of slavery was on color, then I think we would have to conclude, since I have yet to hear people getting around, I haven't heard that many white people saying black is beautiful, then I guess I would have to assume that that particular condition remains for the most part in the American national character. It remains for the most part in the way Americans view themselves and in the way Americans view their fellow Americans. When this was done in our country, this allowed that whole system of rationalization, justification. When we were writing our book, we had a period of, I guess, 2 or 3 months when we completely stopped writing. And it wasn't out of any either writer's cramp or whatever it is. We got depressed because we had, as part of it, gone into slave literature. And this wasn't the historical kind of literature. We had read some of that. This was really just getting slave journals, the kind of thing that you might read now about farm implements or just, you know, what would be thought of as neutral. And every one of those had all kinds of things built into every article. If you were growing potatoes and slaves had to harvest those potatoes, then something about slaves had to be done. If they ran away, it was because that was in the African trait that they ran away. If they got sick, it was because of some weakness of them that was wrong. If they died in childbirth, It was because they really weren't as sturdy as white Anglo-Saxons, and therefore, after giving birth to 18 children in 18 years, if the woman, and this, you know, these are things that, again, this is not interpretation. This is just straight out of slavery journals. So again, I think we must constantly return to the frame of reference that the input into the American national character, the input into the American psyche around color, around inferiority, superiority, has never really been changed. Relentless white oppression has continued. I think if you doubt this, there was a story in the paper, and I'm sure it was up here too, following the Huey Newton trial, where two policemen were angry about the outcome of the trial, and I'm certain if I were a policeman, I would feel the same way. And they shot up the Black Panther headquarters. But I'm certain if I were a Black Panther, I would feel the same way on the other side. And I wonder what would have happened if two Black Panthers had gone out and shot up the police department. Same provocation, you know, because this is kind of the rationalization we got out of Chicago. After all, they were really goaded. What would you do if people were doing this or doing that? So let's say that human feelings are the same, that if I hit you, you're going to hurt and get mad, and if you hit me, I'm going to hurt and get mad, but that you have the freedom to act on that, and I don't. And I think this, again, sets what we're talking about when we talk about racism, because so many times people say, you know, what do you mean racism? I'm not prejudiced, or at least I don't think I am, or my neighbors aren't. And I think it's these kinds of things that when we seriously talk about racism that we've got to address ourselves to. But in thinking of the emotional roots of racism and its victims, we must remember that people bear all they can, and if required, bear even more. But if they are black in present-day America, they have been asked to shoulder too much. They have had all they can stand, and they will be harried no more. Black people of all sizes, shapes, and descriptions are now turning from their tormentors, and they are filled with rage. There is an anger that has always, always been present, even in those nice Negroes with whom you went to school or with whom you worked. Racism has blinded so many Americans that they cannot see what is around them. If you listen closely and you're really concerned about black rage and black anger, you can hear it in a blues song. You might hear it in a spiritual. Sometimes you can even see it when you watch kids dance, that they're angry, that they know that the game is up in terms of what's happening in this country. And, you know, we may decry it and we may say, you know, but it shouldn't be like that, but it's there. It's a reality. I think for just too long, white people have contented themselves that only a few easily identified militants are the angry ones. You know, and all black people are angry. All black people are angry. And if you deny, yeah, this is a sweeping statement. It's a generalization. Take a group of blind people. Do you think that there is a single one who really is not angry because he doesn't have sight? Do you think there's a single one who doesn't have frustration because everybody else can see and he can't see? All black people are angry. I don't know any black person, from the unclest of Uncle Tom to the most turned-on militant, I don't know any black people who aren't angry. Lou Rawls has a blues song that I think appeals to our survival instincts. They say this is a big, rich town, but I live in the poorest part. I know I'm on a dead-end street in a city without a heart. I learned to fight before I was six, the only way I could get along. When you're on a dead-end street, you've got to be big and strong. But if black people are changing, what of their white counterparts? You know, what about changes in this regard? Because I think this is, when we talk about racism, again, this is where we have to get serious, that we can't intellectualize it and abstract it because people are dying and people are frightened and And again, I think we have to go to history. We've got to go to the entire system of slavery. The culture born of that experience has passed from generation to generation. Adaptations and attitudes born of that long ago time continue as present day character traits. This is what people mean when they talk of racism. Not hardcore bigots, not evil people who diabolically arrive at their prejudices, but nice, everyday Americans, like many of you sitting here, who have never challenged their basic thoughts. You know, that's the kind of person that we really worry about. You know, or the person in the university who says, you know, we really need more black professionals and technicians and workers, but after all, our entrance standards are so high that obviously black people don't qualify. Those are the kinds of people, when we talk about racism and races, that's what we're talking about. You know, this is the nitty-gritty. This is the denouement. This is where we must go to talk about it. Many whites, liberal, conservative, the whole gamut, continue to feel like slave masters. Again, this is quite understandable historically when one recalls that many black people continue to feel oppressed, harried, and like slaves, that in order to feel like that, there obviously must be the corresponding other side. Far too many whites, in growing up with the identity of an American, have also acquired the unresolved conflicts of the slaveholder. Any look at underlying black and white attitudes tells us we all have to change our perceptions of ourselves if this country is to survive.
And that was Price Cobbs, co-author with William Greer of the book Black Rage, speaking in Sacramento in 1968, the same year the book came out. Cobbs was a San Francisco-based psychiatrist. That audio comes from the Pacifica Radio Archives. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we'll look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.